this is not my year for TCAF. I'm not doing Emerald. I'll be doing VanCAF, hopefully, if I get accepted. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I'm doing Emerald, and I'm doing VanCAF, and that's it.
I got into Rose City. I'm going to try Rose City this year.
Well done.
We'll see.
Cool.
We'll see how it goes.
Let me know.
I will.
If Ken Wilson's coming to town. That's the only con I'm doing.
Oh, yeah. What's that?
If I get into VanCAF, that's the only con I'm doing. Okay. Maybe Canzine and the Fox. It was actually really good this year.
Yeah.
Like,
your stuff suits Canzine.
Yeah, and I could do, like, some more, like, new little zines. But, yeah, I was surprised at, like, how well it did. Because I was like, I will make $60. And I did not.
There you go.
Hey, I think we somehow ended up in a podcast episode at some point here.
Oh, are we recording?
Oh, my goodness.
Good thing we see you there.
Good thing we had nice things to say about conventions.
That's true. Nothing bad. Welcome to the Trade Waiters. Today's episode, we are going to talk about Bone Volumes 1 and 2 by Jeff Smith. But before we get any further with that, I think we probably should do a character revealing question.
Oh, and an introduction. Yeah.
Right. Angela, this was your pick.
It was my pick. So we'll start with the character revealing question, right? The question that I have for everyone is, have you ever met your cartooning hero?
Ooh, good question.
All right, well, I'm going to say...
Who are you?
Oh, sorry, well...
Who are you?
I'm going to say my name is Jeff.
Yeah, that sounds like lies, but go ahead. Right.
I'm Jeff Ellis. I will take this one first. So I actually did meet a cartooning hero, and actually it's a funny connection because growing up in high school... My favorite comic book artist who drew every issue of Spider-Man that I read was Mark Bagley, who was also the controversial artist who did the flashback superhero sequences from Alias. And I actually met him at one of the early Emerald Cities, back when they were in the football stadium and not in the convention hall. And it was... It actually kind of reminded me of that phrase where they say, you don't want to meet your heroes. Because when I talked to him, he was super, like, just done with Marvel.
Oh, no.
And, like, I was talking to him about, like, oh, didn't you design, like, the new Spider-Man costume? That looked pretty cool. He's like, yeah, I don't get any royalties for that. I'm like you designed Carnage, right? He's like, yeah, I don't get any royalties for that either. Like, he was just super, like... Every conversation I had, every topic was he was just really negative, and he was talking about how much he doesn't get royalties for his work. But in spite of that, I still gave him $50 to draw me Spider-Man in his black costume because he was totally open for cash submissions or cash commissions.
Yeah.
So I am happy with that piece of art, but like my conversation with him was like very. Demoralizing for an aspiring comic book artist.
The moral of the story is don't be that guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm Kay Grotz, and I guess at the time I did meet one of my heroes. When I was 13, I got to meet Brian Lee O'Malley at TCAF in 2007, which is pretty cool, and got, like, my book signed, and, like, I was just this little nerd, kind of freaking out, because that was absolutely, like, my favorite comic series at the time. I'd say probably my current hero is Jillian Tamaki, and I never, ever want to meet her, because that would be too stressful, and it would just be, like, too loaded, and I'd get all panicky, even though she's just a normal human being who makes real good art. I just could never do it. I just want to admire her work from afar. I don't ever need to meet her.
I listened to a panel she did at a convention in San Francisco once, but I didn't get a chance to talk to her.
I was reading an interview with her, and she, like, name dropped the place I work, like the company I work for, and I was like, too much, can't handle it. So,
okay, I'm Jonathan Dalton, and I've met quite a few of my comic book heroes over the years. And I want to pick one that's a good story that I can't remember if I've told my Scott McCloud story on this podcast. I may have.
I think you might have.
Yeah, so I'm gonna tell the audience about Stan Sakai instead. Stan Sakai is great. He's the cartoonist for Usagi Yojimbo. And I've met him a couple of times at conventions. The first time I saw him was at Emerald City 1 year, and of the big name cartoonists who were there, he was the one with no line up at his table, which I took as a personal affront. Like, this is Stan Sakai, why is there no line at his table? So I went and I bought some books from him and I got them signed and I talked to him. And then another year at a different convention, I was actually on a panel with him.
Whoa.
Which was like, ooh, that's a little intimidating to be on the same panel as Stan Sakai. So I went to talk to him ahead of time, and at this point he had heard of me and read one of my books, and had good things to say about it, and that was a very good day. There's more to that story, but I think it might be privileged information, so I'll leave it up.
All right. Well, it was good. It was a nice story. And I am Jam, and the reason that I brought up this story is because I don't think that I have met any of my heroes. Growing up, what I tended to idolize was European comics, like Asterix, which I think I'll be talking more about today, and a lot of manga, which I think I've said very frequently before on other podcasts. So I never had an opportunity to meet Takahashi Rumiko or, you know, like Akira Toriyama or anything like that. And so growing up, as I started getting more and more involved in cartooning and the comic scene, everyone else had heroes that they were like, oh, that person is so-and-so, and they would come to, like, I think Brian Michael Bendis bought one of my books at one point, and I just sold it to him, and,
wow,
like, I think it was, like, you. It's like, that was Brian Michael Bendis, you know, and I'm like, who?
Oh, that's right. I remember that. Yeah.
And what I immediately think about when I hear about Bone is how Jeff Smith is the cartoonist hero to so many people. So the first time I had a tangential encounter with Jeff Smith was, I think, Stumptown, probably 2009 or 2008.
I remember that. He was there.
Yeah, and it was exactly like that. Everyone was saying, Jeff Smith is here. Jeff Smith is at a table. But I'm like, I haven't read Bone. I haven't read any of this. I don't know who that is. So I didn't go and talk to them. And then later at a TCAF, probably 2015, was I there? 2015? 2014? He did a Word Balloon Academy where I got to sit like 4 feet from him and watch him ink.
Oh,
which,
wow.
I mean, I am very impressed with this guy's skill, but he was never my hero.
Huh.
And so that's my Jeff Smith story. Seeing the man ink, he's really good at inking.
There you go.
There was also that time where Boulay was at a convention,
yes,
and you couldn't go, and
no,
I had
so
to,
Boulay is, yeah, another one of my heroes as,
yeah,
well. So finish your story.
Yeah, so I had to go and get a book on your behalf from Boulay, because he only had a limited amount of books. He was only there for like a limited amount of time. He wasn't doing any other conventions that year, at least not in North America. And so I waited in line, and like I hadn't actually read his work except for like a few things on the internet, and I wanted 2 books from him because I was going to get one for you and one for myself.
Mm.
And he almost didn't sell me 2 books.
Oh, no.
Because he was like, 2 books? That's against the rules. Yeah, he had a little sign that said 1 book per customer.
Oh.
But he did let me get 2 books.
Yay.
So
I ended up almost again meeting Boulay later on at TCAF, the most recent one. And a friend of mine was moderating for his panel. And she was like, do you want me to introduce him? I'm like, no, I'm too scared. And so she was with him all day, but like I like, deliberately did not want to get introduced because I knew I would freak out. Kind of like you with Chunk.
Yeah. Be too much.
Too much. But anyway, that brings us today to Bone, which I chose for, or I nominated for this week's podcast, despite never having read it, because over and over again, I've heard that Jeff Smith is hero to many, and I thought I should read Bone. So let's all read Bone. And I've put together a bit of information about Jeff Smith. He started out as an animator, actually. He ran a small animation studio back in the 80s, and he eventually became disillusioned with the animation industry and really was interested in creating animation-style stories with a beginning, middle, and end rather than more issue episodic work, but in the medium of comics instead of animation. So with that goal, he started self-publishing Bone in 1991. And Jeff Smith is really remarkable in the indie small press world because he did really, well, I don't know if he was a pioneer in this space. I think I need to
know more.
I would say I think so.
Yeah, from what I know.
In terms of how he was the one setting up his own distribution channel, he was doing all his own printing and distro and fundraising and going and promotion and still managing the work and all of that. And eventually he brought on his wife to support the business side of that. But that style of working and promoting your own work in 1991 was very unusual. And it was a long road through which he published 55 issues between 1991 and 2004.
Wow.
And those were later collected into 9 black and white volumes and 1 massive omnibus.
I have some of those single issues.
Yeah.
I used to have the omnibus, and I don't know where it is now. So if you borrowed my bone omnibus, please return it. I'm pretty sure it has an autograph from Jeff Smith inside of it.
Whoa, now they're never going to return it. But then Bone was given, I think everyone can agree, a new life when it was used to launch the graphics imprint of Scholastic. So we've discussed this imprint of this publisher, how Scholastic has been taking comics into classrooms.
Oh, yeah.
So graphics, this imprint was one of the first ones to do that, and they started with Bone.
Mm-hmm.
And they have since launched the careers of people like Rena Telgemeier, who is now dominating the charts. And so they re-released all of Jeff Smith's work in full color, and it says it now has more than 6.9 million copies in print.
Wow.
So since Bone, Jeff has been writing Razzle, or he wrote Razzle, and it was about a time-jumping thief, and he completed that in, it started in 2008. His most recent project was a webcomic called Tuki, Save the Humans, but that was put on hiatus in February 2016.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure we haven't seen the last of Jeff Smith. In the meantime, he has collected 11 Eisners and 11 Herbies.
Wow.
And so that's Jeff Smith, and we can now discuss Bone Volumes 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So what's Bone about, Angela?
Bone, as far as I can tell, is about this small bone-like creature named Phone Bone. And his cousin is a miserly rich person who got them all chased out of Boneville as part of their scheme. But over the course of it, they got separated and Phone Bone got lost in the woods. And so these first two volumes, at least, focus mostly on Phone Bone and his adventures in the forest as he's starting to acclimate to this world that has strange magical creatures that he's not used to. And he meets this character named Thorn, and there's a dragon involved, and old ladies and racing cows and stupid rat creatures. And it's a lighthearted fantasy, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I don't know where the story's going after chapter 2, so if that's not what it's about, maybe that's it. Sorry.
Yeah, I have to confess, I've only read, like, one more volume than what we're doing here.
Oh.
I've read a good chunk of it, and there's, like, I think another book that's focuses on a sort of, like, a side story that I've also read, but that was probably 10 years ago. So I only have a vague memory of where this all goes. Because I think we had, if not all, then at least most of the volumes of this growing up. So.
Huh? Yeah, I did not. I'm embarrassed to confess, I did not finish the omnibus that I had. So I don't know how the story ends either.
Wow.
I have to say, after reading these first two volumes, I think I might download the rest of them and get caught up. And I would be interested in the future, potentially visiting another two volumes of Bone here in the future.
Yeah, we definitely can.
Yeah, but I enjoyed this. It was, I think, a little bit of a rough start, which is what all, I think, comic stories, especially of that era, of that self-publishing era, tend to be, is people just are like, I want to start a series, and I want to self-publish it. I'm going to start drawing. And then kind of halfway through, they're like, oh, this probably needs a plot. I should, like, actually get this going somewhere. So I did feel like the first volume felt a lot more meandering. There was a little bit of a plot. And then the second volume, I felt a little more focused because it was all about the cow race. And it really started with the build-up to the cow race and ended with the cow race. And it really just, that had a really solid arc compared to the first volume, which I enjoyed a lot of things about the first volume. I think one of my favorite things, I took a screen cap of it, was like when Bone arrives in the woods and they're saying, you better watch out, like winter comes on really fast here. And then he's sitting under a tree and then this giant like pancake of snow just is hovering above his head for just a second and before it hits, and then it's instantly winter. I thought that was top-notch cartooning.
Oh, yeah.
That is a scene that has stuck with me from, like, my first reading of Bellum. There's just such a great sense of humor in this work. And, like, visually, like, that's just such a funny joke. I don't know.
Yeah. Like, as a teacher, because in my day job I'm an elementary school teacher, like, I just want to say, like, to take off from what Angela said earlier, that this book is, like, foundational to where reading is in classrooms right now. Within a certain age range, I bet you could get, if you were to actually add up the number of kids who have read Bone, it's probably something in the 90% range.
Wow.
And of that 90%, a lot of them have read it more than once. There was a period of time, I think, like, the audience has died off a little bit now that there are more graphic novels to read, but for a while there, school libraries could not keep these books on the shelf. They would be returned by one kid and immediately signed out by another kid in the same class. Librarians didn't even make space for it on the shelf because there would be no point. They wouldn't stay there. These books are, like, they're in every classroom that I've ever been in of, like, within the right age range. And some kids, this is all they'll read. They won't read chapter books. But if there's a copy of Bone in the room, they'll gravitate to that, and they'll read it over and over and over again. Wow. So, like, thank you, Jeff Smith.
And why do you think it is that this work resonates so well with that age range? As I don't think that was Jeff's goal.
No, you're right. I mean, when you read this, it doesn't read like a comic written for kids. I mean, he comes from an animation background, so that might be a factor, but it reads like an indie cartoonist writing for other indie cartoonists. But I think a lot of it is the sort of the sight gags and the like the simple sort of straightforward humor, and the characters are, like, really easy to understand and interesting, and the cartooning is simple enough that you can understand it. Like, the page layouts aren't complicated, but they're effective.
And they're also very well rendered, I would say. Yeah. Like, they're very quick to read in that sense. I would agree with you in that everything is laid out very clearly and with really distinct shapes that have a very clear line of action. And so it's very easy to quickly parse what's happening. It communicates very well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But that's not to say that the work is simple. Mm-hmm. Like, there's so much depth and rendering and, you know, perfection in the execution of a lot of these poses and gestures.
Yeah, and there's a really nice balance between, like, simplified cartoon shapes and, like, really beautifully drawn, like, detailed hatching and, like, you know, brush marks, because the main three bones are so simple, and then, you know, you get to the rat creatures and Thorn and Grandma Ben, and they've got way more rendering and are a little more solid, but it all kind of works together.
I must say that did bother me a little bit. The dichotomy between Bone and Thorn, in particular. Like, I found it just a little bit odd in terms of how the world is being constructed, because there still isn't a lot of information delivered about this world that has both humans and this range of creatures, and the differences in how they're rendered, and a lot of the romance just doesn't play to me very well.
Yeah, right. Yeah. No, that's not right. It's not very well grounded.
No, I have thoughts about just the art difference that are separate, but I did pull up this page specifically because, like, we were talking about it being for kids, and this one page, I was like,
"You're gonna have
this
to tell
seems
us
a little."
Sorry,
I'm introing it to you guys first. So there's a sequence where when Bone first encounters Thorn, she's walking a log, and then he's watching her from a distance, and I guess it's a hot spring. So she takes her pants off and, like, soaks her feet in the hot water. But, like, the sequence of her taking her pants off is really drawn out, and it feels a little pin-up, like, cheesecake in the way it's rendered. Yeah, it's fairly male-gazy. And to cap it off, of course, then the hat that Bone is wearing catches fire again. He had been set on fire by a dragon. The fire reignites after looking at Thorn undressing. And yeah, I felt like pretty much every time Bone is reacting to Thorn, it felt like a Looney Tunes sequence from, like, the 40s, where, like, the beautiful woman walks on scene and the cartoon character, like, starts hitting himself in the head with a shoe or something. Like, it had this real weird male gaze, and also just like the cartoon character can't control themselves. She's just so beautiful. Like,
yeah, kind of the Archie phenomenon where like Veronica Lodge walks by.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think that was fairly strange. I didn't find the difference in the art that different. Like, I didn't find that the difference in rendering threw me off. Like, I sort of accepted that the bones come from Boneville, and they're just these simple kind of white-skinned, like, bubble, like, literal white-skinned, like, bubble creatures. And they just are now in an area where people look human and have, like, pink skin and different hair and eye colors and, you know, and are more proportional to, like, human proportions. But I've seen that in a lot of other works, so maybe it's just something I've kind of become acclimatized to. Like, I used to look at some of the cartoons done by, like, Frank Cho, and, like, I think to a certain degree you saw that a little bit in, like, Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh, absolutely. That's, like, literally humans and cartoons interacting.
Yeah, and it's just sort of, like, to me, like, that weird interplay between, like, a weird bubble character and, like, a more realistic character. I'm, like, I don't know, there's a part of my brain that's just like, yeah, sure, okay.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder why I didn't have the same experience. And I don't know, like, your experience is valid. I think both of our experiences are valid. And I don't know, maybe I wasn't as into Roger Rabbit and those types of cartoons growing up. I was more into cartoons where it's like everyone is either 100% very cartoony or either 100% more human. Like Archie is a good example.
Yeah.
Archie, everyone is rendered in a proportional style all the same. And Asterix is the other one that comes up a lot when I read this work. A lot of the gestures and the motion that seems to happen among these characters, it really shouted Asterix to me more than anything else. But everyone in Asterix is very cartoony.
Right. Mm-hmm. Two interesting things there. So one, I also just realized that Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Frank Cho's cartooning, and this all suffer from this bizarre male gaze, hyper-realistic, beautiful women with goofy cartoon characters that are sexually attracted to them.
Well, Jeffrey, we live in a patriarchy.
It's a trope with deep, deep roots.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. No, so this is all in that same vein, that same patriarchal vein. But then when you said Asterix, I totally don't think Asterix when I look at this. I think Bill Watterson.
Okay.
There's so many poses and facial expressions that I just feel like that is totally Bill Watterson.
I see Watterson in the backgrounds more than anything. So it's
a bit of, I mean, I haven't read this comic outside of just seeing it referenced culturally, but like Pogo a little bit, like that sort of cartoony animal style almost, like it's a little bit what I'm getting here.
Yeah, I had that in my notes too. Pogo and Calvin Hobbes were the ones I felt.
The Wikipedia page said that Pogo was one of the earliest works that inspired him. So,
there
you go.
A good spot.
Very perceptive.
So that being said, like, despite the dichotomy between the two, I did think that Thorne was eventually a very well fleshed out character. I enjoyed reading about Thorne, and I liked her as a character.
Yeah, she's well written.
Like, she interacts with Phonebone and reacts to the way that he's being, like, I don't know. I enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she has she has agency and
a personality.
And Bone is like, even though he's kind of being like a weird goofball, he's not getting too like possessive and strange. You know, like he's attracted to her. He gets a little bit jealous at one part of the story, but like
his response is to write.
His response is not super negative.
There's a sweetness to him.
Yeah.
In the way that it, like, his behavior is motivated. Some of my favorite characters in the book are the rat creatures. I really like, they like really like creep me out when I was a kid. Like, I have a very like visceral reaction where I don't really like to touch the parts of pages if it's visually something I don't like, and I always be like holding it around the rat creatures because there's something really creepy about their like beady, like red glassy eyes, and then their like claws. But Yeah, I always remember the thing about quiche and, like, that coming up over and over again. And the way they're this bumbling incompetence and they just want to eat something tasty. That was and when King Doc shows up, like, their king's a weirdo.
Yeah, that was an amazing running gag. Did you guys, any of you other guys pick up on, like, the way they had characters' faces drawn in their pupils?
Yes, I did notice that. And I thought that was really cool.
The,
yeah,
the cloaked figure in the eyes there.
Uh-huh.
That was repeated throughout the book. So whenever they were looking at someone, there'd be a little drawing of them reflected in the rat creature's eyes.
I did not notice that.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like the rat creatures a lot. But I think even in the first two books, it was hard for me to get a handle on this world and how it was working. There's very little dropped in terms of hints for... Like, we see nothing of Boneville, even.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have no context for what Boneville was like. And how different it actually is from the place that they currently are at. We don't understand what's going on with these shadowy robed figures. The rat creatures seem to be normal, but there's, like, a lot of history, and I don't know. So after two books, I don't have a good grasp of what's plot-wise really going on here.
Yeah.
The writing seems very sort of stream of consciousness. Like, I'm going to do a thing, and then I'm going to do another thing, and I don't know what happens after that, but we'll get to it.
Yeah.
But, I haven't read the rest of it, so I don't know whether that carries forward or whether something pulls together or what.
I definitely, from my memory of reading it, like, it becomes a much larger epic narrative and things get more fleshed out. I'm not sure if I ever read any parts that showed Boneville, but, like, Thorn and Grim Ben's narrative becomes quite complex, and it really becomes a very epic narrative, which you're not really quite at with these first two volumes. It's...
Yeah.
Kind of a slower build, but it does go somewhere.
Yeah, and you wouldn't necessarily want them to achieve that within two books.
Yes.
I just felt like, as a reader, having this being my first exposure to this work, and only two books in, I think the only thing I can pull away from it is, like, confusion. Like, not quite even at the level of, like, I'm intrigued and I want to know more. I'm just like, I still can't quite get a handle on what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I really like Grandma Ben.
I do as well.
She's my favorite character.
She's... great. I need to find a sequence that I really enjoy where she meets Phony Bone and he says something about her cows and there's this like panel of paws and then she's rolling up
When her expression doesn't change.
Yeah, it's like this amazing deadpan.
I think she makes a comment just like, now I'm going to have to punch you or something.
It's page 64 where Grandma Ben is like, being very sweet to Phony Bone and is like, oh, you look like such a nice young man. Would he like to ride on one of my racing cows? And Phony Bone just like, no, I don't want to ride on one of your stupid cows. Panel of paws and Grandma Ben rolling up her sleeves saying, Ted dear, I think you better leave. I'm going to tear this little fellow apart from the inside out.
Yeah, I think she's definitely my favorite character of the work so far. And she came out of like nowhere and has so much depth and personality in her that I don't see even in Bone, in Phone Bone.
Yeah.
So it's, I'm glad she's in the book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would say even within the three brothers, like, Phone Bone is the one you know the least about. Like,
yeah.
Smiley Bone is the goofball, comic relief kind of follower, and then Phony Bone is this, like, awful person who's scheming all the time. And I was like, just like that they come to this town and they find out that they don't have money and they do everything on the barter system, and he immediately is like, how can I like twist this to my advantage?
Okay, I just want to say that there has never been a society that works entirely on the barter system. That is inaccurate.
Yes, that's true.
A small scale society like this that has no currency would work on debt.
Yes.
Like personal debts between people.
Thank you, John, for actually segment of this podcast.
This actually brought to you by the BBC series A History of Debt.
Yes. Which is a good podcast you should listen to after you listen to this podcast.
Yes. So we'll have to send a letter to Mr. Smith to clarify that it's not entirely the barter system, or it cannot have been.
I mean, that's essentially what happens here, though, because they drink all this beer at the tavern, and
yeah, this is true.
They can't give him eggs or milk or whatever, so then they have to become indentured like servants of the tavern until they work off their tab, basically.
They basically become a part of the society because they showed up and they started eating the food.
Yeah.
If we might diverge from that line of thought, one thing that I noticed that was really interesting to me was that there's a limited use of sound effects. So the action and the motion that's put there is so exaggerated and so large that it was very strange to me that these panels, especially panels where Bone is like falling off a cliff, which happens quite a few times, or a lot of the chase scenes, there's like all of this motion and dust and stuff flying up and no sound effects. And as someone coming from a primarily manga background, it was super weird for me to read. And it's interesting to me because I've noticed that happen. And so you see here, it does happen occasionally. Like, there's clip-clop happening, but in the biggest scenes, you don't see sound effects. I've noticed this in Evan Dam's work, in Fatu as well.
Do you think it's sort of a European influence?
I can't quite remember. I need to look it up.
Sorry.
No, it's it does happen.
No, absolutely. But no, I know what you're saying. There's, like, interesting, like, visual cues to, like, stars flying through the chase scenes that we can, like, infer mean pain as opposed to somebody yelling like outer like sounds of that. It's interesting. I don't know. I honestly didn't notice that there were few sound effects, but I guess personally in my own work, like, I just don't include sound effects ever. That's not a way that I think, but it's really interesting to consider.
Yeah, for me, it's such an important layer for, like, the textural addition of sound in a scene is something that I think about, and not to saying like one is better or worse, but it's something that I think about a lot in my work, and so when it's absent, I notice it.
Right. I would say, I mean, something just from flipping through some of the pages, it seems like when he can express it just visually, he will express it visually, but if he does have something where it's happening off-panel, then he is using the sound effects for unseen sounds, but maybe trying to just convey it visually as much as possible, which you referenced the last chapter of book two, which is, I think, my favorite part of this whole series. Was just like, and it's like the everything important is over, and it's just like, I forget the bartender's name, but...
Oh, Lucius.
Lucius is like trying to repair the roof with the help of Smiley Bone, and just the dialogue between those two, and just the I know it's like a cheap gag at the end that, like, Lucius ends up falling off the roof, and it's all these sound effects in the background and Smiley Bone reacting, but just... That just killed me. That was, like, my favorite part of reading these two books. It's just the dialogue between these two characters and the payoff at the end when Lucius falls off the roof. That was laugh out loud funny.
It ain't Bone Bill, but it'll do.
Got a couple criticisms.
Okay.
That. Now I have to put these in context. These are in the context that these books are now primarily consumed as books for kids. In that context... A couple of things that I don't think work very well is, like, the dialogue. There's a lot of made-up spellings for the dialogue, which, for considering the main audience are kids who are not yet ready to read, like, complicated prose books, that seems to me like a shortcoming, that they have to sort of wade through these sort of accents and, like, half-finished words and things like that.
Can you maybe... cite one, because I missed them. I just kind of went...
Okay.
I must have been just super comfortable with it, so I didn't
know. Like, here, this is just a random page. This is some farmer talking to Grandma Ben, and he says, "I'm telling ya, Rose, words out that you're too old to win the race anymore."
Ah.
So, like, they're dropping the ends of words and...
trying to do, like, an accent.
Yeah, dropping G's, dropping E's. Which, as an adult, you can just, like, glide on by that. But for kids, I think that would sort of make them stumble and try to keep up.
Right.
But it doesn't seem to deter them.
No, you're right. It hasn't stopped them, so...
Yeah, I didn't even notice when you... But yeah, now that you bring it up, that's a good point.
And the other thing is that Bone has been banned in different places, like various libraries and schools and things. And I think... like, I haven't done my research on this, but... The last time I read about this, I think the reason given was because of the smoking.
Oh, because of Smiley Bone.
Yeah, there's a lot of smoking in this. Which, I mean, maybe that's a dumb reason to ban a book, most reasons for banning books are dumb reasons. And I'm not sure that would be, if I was looking for an excuse to ban this book, I don't think that's the reason I would pick either. But it's, like, it also doesn't really need to be there.
Yeah.
No, but I guess, that, you know, very much of the time, because, like, yeah. We don't think about smoking much anymore, but, like, I remember the, like, smoking and non-smoking sections of, like, the Tim Hortons, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. But not only that, like, it wasn't Jeff's intent.
Well, yeah, yeah. Like, it's certainly not a pro-smoking comic or anything like that. It's used
everyone
for...
Everyone should smoke.
It's obviously like a callback to, like, old cartoons.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is, like, a school of thought that showing kids people smoking is normalizing it so that it's maybe easier for them to start smoking when they're older. That's the I don't know if I agree with it, but I think that's the thinking.
Mm, yeah.
Is that you just don't want kids to see smoking depicted positively or to be depicted without having consequence. Because, like, then it sort of builds that thing in kids' minds where, like, well, I mean, Smiley Bone smokes a cigar all the time. He's fine. Like, why can't I smoke a cigar?
And to be fair, I don't think there has ever been... I would want some evidence that there has ever been a kid who found out that Smiley Bone smokes and decided that that was the reason they were going to start smoking.
See,
this
no,
is the model. I'm going to face my life.
I think, see, I don't think I agree with it, but I'm just playing devil's advocate, which is I think that the thought process there is that it's normalizing it so mm-hmm. that when that kid grows up and is like a young adult, they don't have negative thoughts about smoking. They're like, well, those cool characters I used to read smoked. Maybe I'll like smoke too. Like, it's not like a kid will start smoking, but it'll like contribute to decisions later in life.
Today's Devil's Advocate was brought to you by yes. Canadians Against Smoking.
Yes.
Oh, these are some real winner segments. We should have them every episode.
we need some actual advertisers.
The next thing we need is like male opinions, TM.
We can do that.
And that's next episode, we'll have Mansplain Corner.
Oh, good. What does that mean? I don't think I understand.
It's a trap.
Okay.
So, can we talk about the color really quick?
Sure.
Sure.
Because I think these were originally black and white. That's
yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Originally red bone and black and white.
I have never seen black and white.
Neither have I.
Yeah, and the inking is definitely something, as I was reading, I was going, this is beautiful. Take notes.
Yeah, I mean, you can see, like, I've never actually read it in black and white, I don't think, or at least I haven't in a really long time. So, but you can look, just looking at the pages in color, you can tell that these would work without color.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the inking is so strong mm-hmm. that you could take the color out and it'd be fine.
Yeah.
Pretty sure the color's only there because kids are more likely to read it if it's got color.
It definitely does make it a richer experience.
Mm.
Yeah,
it's a texture, it's an enhancement, but I think I agree with you. Like, the work is done in the inks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the color gives it something extra. I enjoyed reading this in color, I think, a little more than in black and white.
Okay.
And I think, especially if it's going for kids, then yeah, color is like a must. Kids love color.
Supposedly. That's the theory. I don't know if that's ever been tested.
I wonder, I think about this a lot, the difference between black and white and color works, because I really enjoy working in black and white, but I think it's been shown, at least in terms of, I mean, sales, and if you spend enough time at conventions looking at people reacting to different types of works and seeing how people react to different types of color or black and white works, color does seem to work for people in a different way.
Mm.
I don't know if it's better or worse, but it's a different experience fundamentally. And I think I've heard a friend, one of the books that I really enjoyed when I was a teenager was Johnny the Homicidal Maniac, which is not only black and white, but like a really aggressively bold type of black and white. And I gave it to one of my friends because I really like this book. You should read it. And he said it was too loud.
Hmm.
And it's funny because I have other friends, like Sam Logan is another one, who I can't read enough of his work on the screen because it is too loud in black and white. Mm. And I read his work in print because it's a little bit more comfortable. So I wonder if the addition of colors, even though the inks are doing a good job, they soften the experience enough that it's more comfortable to read maybe over and over, maybe over a longer period of time.
That could be. That makes sense.
I'm not 100% sure if this was from Scott McCloud or not, but I remember reading someone's sort of essay on black and white versus color comics, and they were saying that a color comic you respond to emotionally because color makes you respond emotionally, like you're looking at a painting.
Hmm.
Where black and white inked comics, you're responding to more intellectually because you're analyzing the lines to make the pictures. So you're thinking about, you're forming the picture by analyzing the lines, and then you're reading the words. But when it has color, you're just responding to like the emotional impact of the color and then reading the words.
Interesting. Yeah. So it's almost like you read it first through color, and then you absorb the dialogue through it. I don't know.
Yeah, like I've heard some people say that like if you want people to really think about the story, black and white is a better way to go because people will really think about the actions and the storytelling. If you want people to have an emotional reaction, you want color, because color is where you can really start to bring out like those heavier emotions, right? If you're telling more of an intellectual story, you want it more black and white. That's what I've heard. I think that's a Scott McCloud chapter in one of his books.
I don't remember it.
Yeah.
I don't know, but that's definitely something interesting to consider, like, as a cartoonist.
Yeah, I think it's something that I will be thinking about more, and I don't think it's anything that we can conclude here. I think it's so complex, the reader experience, and I don't think it's universal at all.
Oh, absolutely not.
So it's just, it's interesting to me, because this is such a work that was so seminal in black and white, and has received such life and success in color. And there's other examples of works that have been done in black and white and then colorized and not found as much success. I think there's an example that I see cited quite often are versions of Mobius's works that have been recolored to their detriment, some people say.
Okay, yes, I've seen, yeah, I've seen that, yeah.
Yeah.
I also think it takes, like, a really skilled colorist to work with a piece where the inks are, like, speaking very strongly to take that and then make it work with color. Because, like, you know, sometimes, especially I feel like this happens in some superhero comics where, like, the penciler is doing their best to do their craft the best that they can be. The inker wants it to be the best inks it can be. The colorist is, like, trying to make it the best colors, but they don't all work together.
So,
finding a colorist who can really work in, like, making a graphic black and white image into a very engaging color image, like, that's quite a skill. And do we know who the colorist is on this, if we're talking about
that's
color?
That's a good question.
I feel like we should... Color by Steve Hamaker.
Okay.
Because, I feel like it's a pretty great color job.
Yeah, for sure.
I really like it anyways.
Yeah, no complaints. It's hard to say whether it's better or worse. I have not read the alternative, but I really enjoyed the work
in
color.
It's a very nice subdued palette.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think when we talk about superhero comics, I find a lot more superhero comics tend to go into the brighter primary palette. This feels a little more like a muted, like a pastel palette. And I think that helps the colors take a back seat and let the ink still do the heavy lifting.
Yeah, I think you're right. Especially since he's using so many spot blacks.
Mm.
If there was also aggressive competition in the color with those spot blacks, I don't think it would... As we were saying, like, the panels read very quickly and very clearly.
Mm-hmm.
And high contrast colors would maybe compete.
Yeah.
So, Steve Hamaker, good job.
Yes. Excellent colors. Okay, then I think we have said all we want to say about Bone. I'm really glad that I no longer have to say it is a book that I haven't read. I really enjoyed it, and I would recommend it. It's a book that is enjoyable to read, and it's like it's worth having in your life.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised that you hadn't read it before when you suggested it. I just assumed that this was like something you'd grown up reading and were like excited to share with us. So this is great. I'm glad you got me back to it, because like I said, I read a part of the omnibus and then I got something happened, I didn't finish it. Now I want to read all of Bone. So I highly endorse this book.
Yeah, I'm still like 90% of my students have read the entire series, and I have not. So I'm still behind them in this, but at some point I really need to read the rest of it so that they can stop shaming me by saying, like, you haven't read the rest of Bone? Like, everybody's read Bone. Sorry.
Yeah, this is a great series. I'm looking forward to rereading the rest of it. I would absolutely recommend it. Should we do where you can find us and shoutouts?
Sure.
Okay, I can go first, I guess.
Yep.
I'm Kay Gross, and you can find my currently updating webcomic at lunarmalodies.com. And over Christmas, I was alone and cat-sitting at a house of someone who owns very good comics, and I read all 6 volumes of Wet Moon, And that is a fantastic comic. If you haven't read it, like, 11 out of 10 would recommend. It's by Sophie Campbell, and it's just, oh, it's so good. If you love, like, teen dramas, go for it.
I second that recommendation.
Okay, I'm Jonathan Dalton. You can find my work at phobos-comic.com. And I just finished listening to the audiobook for The Lathe of Heaven by Ursula Le Guin. And oh my goodness, what a good book. Like, I am already a huge Ursula Le Guin fan, and I think this is one of my favorites of hers. I can't believe I haven't read this before. It's just, I haven't even, like, finished processing in my brain everything that's in this book. It's good. I don't even want to tell you what it's about. You gotta read it.
All right. I guess, am I next? All right.
Sure.
So I'm Jeff Ellis. You can find my work at jeff-ellis.ca. And I'm going to shout out Habitat by Simon Roy, which is a collection of what was shorter chapters in the Island anthology series, and that got put together in a graphic novel. And I just finished reading that a few days ago during the holiday break, and I enjoyed it a lot. It's some really good science fiction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Last but not least, I'm Jem. I don't know what prog anymore.
You have one, it's just not updating. You can still read it.
It's finished.
No, it's done. It's deleted.
No, don't. I hate it when people do that.
My shout out is for A Softer World, another comic that has ended and has been deleted from the internet. But
so you can't read it.
You can't read it.
Recommended.
I was reading it back in November when I was feeling very sad, and the book that I was reading was called The Anatomy of Melancholy, and it's a poetic experience. And I really enjoyed reading it, and I would like to read more. That's my shout-out for this week.
Okay.
Awesome.
What's our next book going to be?
Oh, yeah! Oh, I chose this one. We're going to be reading Today is the Last Day of the Rest of Your Life by Uli Luce.
The Trade Waiters takes place in the library. They let us record here for reasons.
The VPL has good programs.
Thanks, VPL.
Thank you, Sleuth, for the music. Yes?
Find us
yes.
on SoundCloud.
Or Tumblr. Or
Google Play.
Or Facebook.
Facebook.
Stitcher.
Even.
Yeah.
Twitter.
iTunes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're around.
Yeah. Or just, you know, flag us down on the street. Actually, no, don't do that. Okay. That's
you
it.
Can just pull one out from another one and just tack it on.
I could do that, I suppose. That one was more fun, though.
Okay. All right. Well, there we go. Bye, everyone.